Well, we start off with the music of Haggis Horns, and how can you beat that? A great way to start off any week. Good morning, all. Welcome to the roundtable panel and to our group this morning. We're going to sit around this roundish table and talk about an elongated amoeba-like table that has rounded edges and just theater of the mind. Think of it as a round table. And we'll have wonderful, wonderful people, very, very smart and enthusiastic people talking about the issues of the day. And we welcome you to join that esteemed group by simply writing to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Much to discuss on a busy Monday, so let's get started. We welcome political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine.
Okay.
Yeah. All nice. Yeah. It was a beautiful weekend. It was very nice. Weather-wise, all good. So, feeling all right? You getting,
I'm getting there. I'm getting there.
Libby had surgery.
Yeah.
And on hip.
Right, hip replacement.
And is recouping nicely. So,
yes.
5 weeks out and still in here and about.
Yeah.
And so, congratulations. And
oh, thanks so much. It adds to all the other 60% of my major joints are now titanium and plastic. It's a wonderful thing.
Well, 40 to go. Let's go.
No. I'm done. I am so done.
Well, whatever form your joints are in, we're thrilled that they're here with us this morning. So thank you very much. Nick Rangel is here as well, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Nick Rangel, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm doing great. We're looking forward to the Lasny Golf Classic. It's our actual first inaugural golf classic. It's not classic yet, but it's September 23rd. And if you're interested in playing, people should go to our website.
And the website is Lasny.
Lasny.org, LASNNY.org.
Excellent.
Keep calling it classic, and then it will be.
Yes. Some people call it a classic, and so that's what I'm calling it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, if it's a, you know, if it's a classic in form event, then, I think you're fair.
It's classically golf.
Yeah, there you go.
It's actually going to be a little bit silly. We've got some silly games for the non-serious golfers.
Well, it'll be a wonderful event and very important, obviously, to help you all out. So good to take part. So
thanks so much.
Lasny.org and find out more information about that. Mark Whitman is here, Wall Street investment banker. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. It's a nice Monday morning so far. I'm happy.
Good. Well, we'll try not to screw that up. We are thrilled to have the mayor of the very city that we sit in right now, the mayor of Albany, New York, Kathy Sheehan. Good morning, Mayor. How are you?
I am great. I have received multiple emails from Nick inviting me to said classic golf tournament. I agree that it is a beautiful, wonderful day. And it's great to see Libby here moving around and with a smile on her face. So all is well.
Well, it's great to have you back. Last time we spoke to you, you were in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention. That ended Thursday night. Travel back on Friday. So you're starting to get back to whatever a normal week is for a mayor of a city of Albany. I don't even know if there is such a thing as a normal week.
Yes, we had house guests and a family wedding. So I did finally, I think, get some rest last night. And just for all of your benefits, I heard tell that apparently many people brought COVID back from the convention with them, but I tested and I do not have COVID. So,
well, thank you for not bringing that souvenir back from
it's
the convention, but we thank you and anybody coming from anything. I mean, COVID is very much back and is around and rearing its head. We have a new there's a new shot coming out, a new injection, so something to keep in mind, and so all of that is happening as we finish up these final days of summer 2024. So now we move to you had the Republican convention, and then you had the Democratic convention, and then in between the Democrats changed candidates, and there was a before that, there was assassination attempt. There's just a lot going on. So the next big event on the calendar is September 10th, which is going to be a debate between between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. But oh, wait a minute. This morning, the president is saying that he may not show up at that
Which
debate.
President?
The former president of the United States. Yes, the former president of the United States.
Joe Biden still may show up in the debate.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
So Trump is saying he may not show up?
Yes. He is casting doubt this morning, and there is a debate over you. Now, in fairness, just a little bit of background here, but Trump has not been happy about this ABC debate since the very beginning, because he felt that ABC is a very biased news organization against him. So, but then he said he was going to leave, and Kamala Harris said, "Well, okay, fine. Like I'm, you know, if you want to go do whatever it is you do, I'm going to be there no matter what." So, all right. So then he said, "Okay, I'm going to be there." Now they say that there is a dispute over the rules. Here is the dispute. Trump's team, according to sources, would like for the microphones to be muted throughout the debate, except for the candidate whose turn it is to speak, as was the case during the first debate with President Joe Biden. And Trump himself took aim at what he called the biased network, complaining about reporter Jonathan Carl and a panel of Trump haters on his Truth social platform. Why would I do the debate against Kamala Harris on that network? The former president asked. The Harris campaign is requesting that ABC and other networks seeking to host a potential October debate keep microphones on, according to a senior campaign official, marking a change from the June debate when the then Biden campaign wanted microphones muted, except when it was a candidate's turn to speak. We have told ABC and other news networks seeking to host a possible October debate that we believe both candidates' mics should be live throughout the full broadcast, according to Brian Fallon, the Harris campaign senior advisor for communications, in a statement. I don't know how I feel about that, because it seemed to me that that was one thing. Everything went really horribly wrong in that first debate. But the one thing that seemed to be good was the fact that there was a muting of the microphones. And so for that to be changed, I don't exactly understand the strategy, but there's
a
strategy.
Look, you know, if they keep the mics on and he interrupts her, it's going to be bad news for Trump interrupting Kamala Harris, because she is going to say, "Excuse me, I'm speaking," and just keep going. And then when he says something stupid, she'll just pounce right on him in her regular prosecutorial way. So, you know, I think he's scared blankless. I think that's what's going on.
Actually, I wonder, he needs the news media back on him, both emotionally and from a campaign perspective. I think the Harris campaign needs to be careful. And I think with all this stuff, I would try to give a very direct, simple response. And I would, in part of that response, I would encourage the media not to focus on Trump's temper tantrums, frankly. I think that's the bigger danger here. I actually thought in the first debate, Biden would have been saved had Trump's mic been on many times. It just the fact that, particularly the fact that Biden couldn't use all of his time in many cases when he should have been able to, made his inadequacies even more stark. And I think I think Libby's right about why the Harris campaign would prefer them to be on.
Well, by the same token, I mean, it seems that, well, I agree with you. I agree with you entirely. It seems as though if we were to prognosticate and play this out, Mayor, wouldn't it be that, okay, Trump complains about this, says that the whole world is against him, they're ganging up, this is clearly an attempt to make him look bad, okay, I'll show up, and then if it goes poorly, that's why it went poorly.
I think that that might be giving him a little too much credit. I think he's just...
Okay.
I mean, when you think about the debates, in 16 and in 20, I was sitting in my living room saying, just turn his mic off. Mm-hmm. So to me, the person who benefited the most from open mics in past debates, it was Donald Trump. So that seemed to be something that was right up his alley. And you would think that if it were the other way around, he'd be the one objecting. But we'll see. I agree. I don't think that we want the Harris campaign to get derailed by what most people look at as some sort of technicality, and who really cares. We want to see a debate.
Yeah, I think Trump is also trying to create this. There's been this narrative that Harris hasn't been doing interviews. Harris isn't in front of the cameras enough. We're not hearing enough about her policy agenda or the details of the policy agenda. And in contrast, that framing suggests that Trump is. And I think he's trying to tee himself up to have continued news coverage, interview coverage, but maybe not put himself in a debate situation with Harris where his lack of detail will become more apparent, and she is great on her feet and she'll be able to really spar aggressively back with him.
And can I just, though, react to that? Because I was hearing this at the convention that, you know, short on details, a lot of criticism of Harris and policies. And I had no idea what the media was talking about. I mean, unless Donald Trump is going to embrace the 2025 and say that that's his policy, what does he have? I mean, with Harris, we understand what the policies are with respect to immigration. I would sign bipartisan immigration legislation that should have been passed by Congress. We know what she is looking to do with respect to home ownership, with respect to tax cuts. I mean, she's laid it all out. I have no idea what he would do from one day to the next, to the next, to the next. And I think that it's just, again, you know, I don't want to paint everything as sexism or as gendered, but it was soul crushing for me to hear that, because I was there. We were hearing policy after policy after policy. There were substantive meetings that were happening all through the day during the convention. If reporters wanted to go and hear about the various platforms, they had the opportunity to do that. It was there. But this was a convention. You know, it was not a white paper. And, I found that very frustrating when I would read the paper and say, what are you talking about?
So let me just ask a slightly a version of the question, which is it's become a thing that a bug in the bonnet of the media and her opponent that she has not done a direct interview or a press conference. So I'm going to take a slightly different tact. Instead of saying, should she, I'm going to say, what does she have to lose? Like, what is there? Why not just do it, get it out of the way, and move on?
Well, first of all, she's been, the nominee for a week or less, and the candidate for, 4 weeks, 5 weeks? They've had to put together a whole operation in that time, and they've done a tremendous job. I mean, the convention, from somebody who watched it at home, was a great success. But they've had to put this all together, and nobody's really paying attention. No one's really, except us. I mean, except us political animals, nobody's really paying all that much attention. And once Labor Day comes and goes, that's when she'll start doing the press interviews, because that's when people are going to start paying attention. Vacations are over. In Albany, everyone will be home from the Cape. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of things that people are still doing. And they just, you know, are, I think it is sexism that they are just demanding this stuff of the woman candidate because she's a woman. And what is she afraid of? She's not afraid of anything, you know. If it's anything, the other side should be a little afraid, and I think they are, which is why he's not going to saying what he's doing about the debate. But it will all happen, but it will happen in a time frame when it has the most impact for the campaign.
Well,
but,
and she's been a bit busy, right?
Yeah.
So choosing a vice presidential running mate and then planning an entire convention, including
I reject that.
Who is speaking, when they're speaking and when there is something for her to sit down and talk about after the media and after the country has had the opportunity to see and meet and understand who she is. I mean, trying to cram that in the timeline that Libby's talking about, I think is unfair.
Okay, mm-hmm. Look, I disagree with you because Trump was able to do that and be convicted. So I think, you know.
But it was so much
you're
longer.
Asking for a lot.
But it was such a long period of time.
But I guess, but to your point, too, earlier of the policy after policy after policy, they have the policies. She's articulate on the policies. Okay, Mark is raising his eyebrows. We can get to that after the break. But articulate on the policies. And I just wonder, like, if it just seems to be the one thing that they're, like, glomming onto. So let it go away. Make it go away.
And it will. It will when the timing is right. Why is it that a campaign needs to be in a total response-only mode? Why can't it be on the offensive and it determine when it's going to do certain things? And the timing is just not right. It's the end of August. Kids are going back to school. College is starting. People are not paying attention. They do this in September when people pay attention.
I will say that my colleagues in journalism may be mad at me, but I think they're making an awful lot of fuss over her not answering questions. I'm pretty sure that when they actually sit down to ask her questions, they're not going to be on policy, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, they'll ask her about Gus. You know, they'll ask her things that aren't, that are relevant, but are not, that are fluff.
Do you want a minute and a half, or do you want to wait till after the break?
I'll start. You'd stop me if we get to a dangerous point. Look, I agree from a I want to win the election standpoint, and I think this it's important to win this one. If I'm Kamala Harris's campaign, I weigh the cost in terms of potential votes of delaying my interview or interviews against how I think I'm going to do in those. Now, I think we ought to be frank with ourselves. If Pete Buttigieg were the candidate, he'd be already doing interviews because that's one of his superpowers. This is a candidate who's historically had trouble, so she ought to – I get it. The campaign should coach her up to the nines before she gets on and does these interviews. The one thing I would suggest if I were they is I think she needs to start doing them with a bunch of them with local media so that the stakes are low. She can learn. They can do any cleanup they need to. And by cleanup, I don't even mean it's her fault, just that – arises out of inherently out of a discussion and the editing that takes place. So I think we should admit that what we're seeing here, I also do think the press is falling into tropes. It's sort of some of these articles about, oh, she needs to tell us her policy, she needs to do interviews. They're like rewarmed from the last campaign, and I think they missed the point, which is if you're Harris, it's just win, baby, win.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. All right, we've broken out into individual discussion groups during the meeting and the break, but that's okay. That's good. We'll call it rehearsal. That's fantastic. Yeah. Mark, is there anything you would like to add before I go to Nick?
No, I'm okay.
Okay. Nick Rangel.
Well, in the break we were starting to chat a little bit about the specificity that is available on Harris's specific policy platforms, and I think one of her strongest areas is housing policy, but one of the weaker areas is precisely how you break up the grocery store monopoly. And I think that was where I get a little more hung up on, like, what does that even look like? What does that really look like? And where is the specificity in that policy? But I think the point is that the specificity in Project 2025 is so traumatizing that the lack of specificity in how you break up a grocery store monopoly is maybe not the thing to hang that election on. And I try to kind of come back to, like, let's give her some time to effectuate some of these plans. we have models for her housing proposal, for example, from New York and California. And you could see some of the progress that's been happening at the state level and how that would play out on the national level just from a data perspective. And I think it's pretty promising.
Well, and I think about, you know, this idea of, all right, well, what's where is the bar, right? Is that, you know, we know we have somebody who was president before and we saw what they did and the specificity or lack thereof of their policies. And so we had a guy who said, I'm going to end Obamacare and replace it with something better that he never did. He said that he was going to have infrastructure week every week and we never got infrastructure reform. He said he was going to fix the border, and we ended up with even more chaos and more confusion, and nothing, no policy ever got initiated. There was no actual legal reform that got through. I think, and he raised the deficit by trillions of dollars, two trillions of dollars. I don't know. You can't keep track anymore. Yeah. But my point being that when you look at the Biden-Harris administration and what they said they were going to do and what they have done, there might be some people who don't like what they've done, but they said they were going to do things, they executed those policies, and they did them. And I think when you look at the values of a Harris administration, focusing on the middle class, focusing on America's families and the issues that are important to them, the details of these policies will be worked out with Congress. But the desire to make more middle class people homeowners is core to who Kamala Harris is. And I like that. And her desire to have people be able to go to the grocery store and not worry about how they're then going to fill a prescription drug prescription for their family is a value that she holds. And she will figure out how to do that. And so that, I think, is what people need to focus on. And talking less about, you know, where is the specificity?
And I also think you need to look at the Trump 4 years, the cabinet turnovers, the inability to do anything policy-wise because everybody left because they all thought he was a lunatic. You know, 17, 18 of former cabinet members and the chief of staff, nobody's endorsing this man.
And then 40 out of 44 right. refuse.
Yeah, and then you look at the Biden administration, hardly anyone has left, right? They're all doing their job. They're all working on the policy. And that commitment to policy will continue under a Harris administration. It's really just that simple. If you want chaos, we go back to Trump. If you want stability and the ability to move the country forward, it might not be what everybody wants, but at least it'll be protecting people without means, which is really what we need to do here. You know, that's what you're going to get with a Harris administration.
Yeah. I mean, on one hand, you have a person who wants to help people put down payments down on first homes. On the other hand, you have a person who has literally said that he will remove immigrants from their homes so they can give those homes to American people and then deport those immigrants. And when you ask which immigrants?
Right.
There's a lack of specificity there. And if that doesn't scare the bejeebus out of us, like what will?
Good point, Mark.
No, I agree with Nick and the mayor. Look, my economics brain, which sits right next to my lizard brain, when it read Kamala Harris's policy, I mean, I giggled. It's hilarious. I mean, but this thing about countering price gouging in grocery stores, for instance, and the $25,000. There's a lot of doubt about the $25,000 gift for down payments, if you will. But I want Kamala Harris to win. For all the reasons previously stated over the last 10 years. And I think tactically, she ought to just go ahead and promise that when she gets the steering wheel, it's all rainbows and unicorns, because it does tactically put Donald Trump into a difficult position when he says, no, you can't have those gifts, and here's why. It makes it hard for him to take on that policy. And so go have at it. And I'm not really worried that a lot of these things that Harris says she wants to do are ever going to take place in the real world, but I'd much rather her be president. Matter of fact, we were talking the other day, and I said, even if Kamala Harris were to reach over her chin and pull back her Tom Cruise silicone mask and reveal herself as the other Donald Trump, at least Tim Walz would be the vice president if she wins. there's no situation in which I don't want her to become the next president as opposed to the alternative.
So I want to get to letters on this, but just some updating here. Vice President Kamala Harris and running mate Tim Walz entered the weekend energized from the national convention. They look to keep up their momentum. The campaign announced Sunday that it raised $82 million during the convention last week, with the best hour coming after Harris delivered her acceptance speech Thursday night. Former President Donald Trump and his running mate, J.D. Vance of Ohio, have planned several events in swing states this week, while Harris and Walz will embark on a bus tour of Georgia. Meanwhile, the latest polls from the weekend show a bump not only from the convention, but a bump in the swing states, where Kamala Harris was either tied or down by 2 points or so. And in those states where she's tied, she seems to be pulling ahead. And in the states where she was down 2 or 3 points, she seems to be in a tie. Still an extremely close race. I don't think we can stress that that enough. Well, let's go to the letters. I do want to get to the Trump event at the wall that Obama built, but we'll we'll hold off on that for just a few minutes. But it's hard. Not surprised that that Wall Street guy.
There you go.
Would try to slip in a few negatives, especially when Trump seems unable to even complete a coherent sentence. Plus, as Libby suggested, the media should insist on truthful policy from Trump before demanding the same from Harris. But it's access, right? I mean, that's what they're complaining about.
Yeah, they want access, and I get that, and they'll get it, you know? They're on the buses, let's be honest. We've all watched The West Wing. We've all watched all the movies about campaigns. They're following along on the buses. They'll be able to ask questions as they go along. They'll be able to cover all the speeches that the both of them are doing and then be able to ask questions. So they'll have their access. So, you know, everybody just needs, I keep saying this, everybody just needs to calm down, right? They just need to calm down. All of this will work out. The problem, I don't want to say it this way. It's not a problem per se, but journalists want things when they want them. I have a deadline, blah, blah, blah. You know, I have to do it right now. Well, you know, life doesn't work on their deadline sometimes. And people just need to recognize that. And then this is a major presidential campaign.
I don't disagree with you, but 70 days.
Huh?
But 70 days.
Yeah, 70 days. 70 days of coverage. Can you imagine how many stories can be written in 70 days?
Well, the news media is also lazy. And so they've warmed this topic up and they'll ride it to fill print until she starts giving interviews.
Our journalistic colleagues on this panel must be just going nuts right now. But that's all right. They'll be here tomorrow. Joe writes...
Keeping my mouth shut.
You don't have to. Joe writes, if Trump's own campaign and handlers are stating he cannot act presidential for 90 minutes during a debate, how will he be presidential for 4 years? Well, I think we know how he'll be presidential.
He won't be.
I think we know that,
it's been asked and answered.
Yes. Over the weekend, I read somewhere that Harris should not go into a lot of detail about policies because if Congress is a majority of Republicans, it'll be difficult or impossible to implement them, which looks bad. Under promise, over deliver. That from Tricia.
Well, but I think that the case that Hakeem Jeffries made, you know, he was up there in support of Vice President Harris, but he was up there running for Speaker of the House.
Oh God, yes.
And so I think that to the extent that we're talking about implementing changes and policies that help working families, that we should speak to that in detail and also make it clear it only happens if there's a majority of Democrats in the House and in the Senate, because this is about a fight for both of those as well.
And I want to emphasize, particularly for folks in New York, you have to think long and hard about our role in this next election to the extent that there's a possibility that Donald Trump wins. Last time round, anybody who got scratched or bitten turned. So even Republicans who seemed like they weren't going to bend the knee or kiss the ring did, or almost all of them did. And I think that I'm not voting for a Republican for a national office until Trump is off the scene, because I'm afraid of that. Even if somebody looks me in the eye and tells me they're not going to get infected by the virus, almost all of them always do.
Well, look at all the Republicans who came and spoke at the convention. Adam Kinzinger, Troia, I think her last name is. She was National Security Advisor for Pence. I mean, there were a number of people who got up, you know, Ray Cooper, got up and said, look, this is not what the Republican Party is about. You're not going to be, you know, dissing the party by voting Democratic. What you're doing is being a patriot, because it's about saving democracy. And it really, really is. I mean, my fear with the Trump presidency is the media. He will do what he needs to do to shut that down. He will do what he needs to do to silence the voices. You know, and I this might seem trivial, but what is he going to do to Randy Rainbow? Because Randy Rainbow is a great satirist, right? And he does great videos, and it's all musical, and it's very entertaining. But I can see Trump really going after people like him to shut them down so that their voices are totally obliterated. And that's what scares me more than anything else. It's the threat to our democracy and what this man stands for. He is a tyrant, and he wants to be Vladimir Putin. It's just that simple.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll get to more letters. We have many. We welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back. Nine 9:48 on a Monday morning for the August 26th edition of the Roundtable panel. And we have Nick Rangel, Mayor Kathy Sheehan, Mark Whitman, and Libby Post. What trouble are you causing?
Well, I think we need to. Mark needs a gay LGBT studies 101 class. He doesn't know Randy Rainbow. He doesn't know lesbian gym teachers. I mean, you know, what's going on here?
Well, you can break out into individual discussion groups, as I mentioned.
Yes, we
earlier.
Could. We'll figure that out. We'll do a CR group for you.
Fantastic. All right. To be a fly on the wall for that.
Yeah.
Ricardo says the media has been suckered in by Donald again when he complains about Kamala not giving interviews. She's already been more detailed in laying out what she will do than Donald has been, though he's had so much more time. Get off Kamala. Get off, hey media, point out how sneaky, untruthful Donald is instead. That from Ricardo.
The other thing about the media, and a friend of mine just texted me this, is that it's a 24/7 news cycle. It used to not be that way when I was a kid. It was, you know, Huntley, Brinkley, and that was it. And so we now have this news cycle that we have to fill with stuff all the time. And that's part of this whole thing of, oh, she's not talking to us, because they need to fill. They need talking heads.
I also think, and Mayor Sheen mentioned this, but for the media to say, well, Donald Trump's been more specific is laughable. Because yeah. What's the correlation between what he says and what he does? Right? It's meaningless.
Well, I do think, though, when Donald Trump gives an interview, then that the words he speaks become fodder for additional clicks and likes and interactions on socials. And so there's like a big kind of value to the person who gets to do that interview, and then also to like the rest of the media universe who can pull, you know, some craziness out and make it its own story. I also have to give a shout out. My niece, Sarah, is listening, and it's her first time listening and tuning in. So maybe we have a new listener to the roundtable, but...
Oh, that's great. Am I allowed to ask how old she is?
You are. She's 8.
Oh, that's great.
She's 8?
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Oh,
you're indoctrinating her.
Yes.
Yeah, that's
we'll
what the other side is.
Sure am.
Saying. Right.
Yeah. She's also going to go to UAlbany, because I'm on the Alumni Association, and we go to lots of events, and I'm like, you know, UA everything, right?
Tell her to go to Rockefeller.
That's fantastic. Very, very good. Well, welcome, Sarah. Very nice to have you listening. We go to this from John. Kamala Harris could have interviews, and then they would be on her for something else. Trump will constantly be looking for something to attack her on, and so far has found nothing that has stuck, which certainly seems to be the case so far. Then we go to Eric Libby. Your explanation for why Harris isn't sitting for real interviews or giving real press conferences is plausible, but it would be more convincing if we heard it directly from the Harris team. Instead, when asked about why she isn't answering questions, they have been responding with sophistries like Kamala has been speaking directly to the voters instead.
Well, there is something to be said for that. After all, they're the ones who are going to be voting.
Craig says, it may be thanks to you guys, but I've never watched a convention before last week. Each night, I don't know if it's thanks to us because he now has watched a convention or that he has never watched a convention because of us. I'm not sure exactly how that works, but we'll see. Each night, I turned it on, and I couldn't stop watching. Anyone who doesn't know her position on policy is simply not paying attention. Then Mark writes, I watched every minute of the Democratic convention and loved it. I thought there was a substantial amount of policy being discussed, especially when compared to the other guy who has nothing but threats and accusations as his policy platforms. I agree. I think it was with Libby that the media is absolutely out of their minds when they were what they're saying that the policy was absent.
And the mayor.
Can I say though, you know, about this, I'm speaking directly to the American people. You know, to Nick's point, this is about selling ads for the media. This is about clickbait.
Right.
This is about getting people behind paywalls. And it is not as democratic as it used to be. I'm sorry. I just have to say, more media does not mean more accessible media. And so when you think about what is driving this constant focus on this issue, we have to recognize that there are profits directly behind it. This is about making money for the media.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, I think bringing your case directly to people. I'm a surrogate for the campaign, so I helped kick off a phone bank last night that was on the West Coast calling into Arizona, 9 o'clock our time, which is midnight for me. And just so everybody knows that, don't call me after 9 o'clock. But there were people from New York City, from Georgia, from all over the country, hundreds and hundreds of people who were fired up, who said, Michelle Obama told me I had to do this, and so I'm doing it, making phone calls into Arizona. So she is reaching the people who are going to be voting for her. Her message is resonating with folks who are not just listening to that and saying, okay, I'm going to vote in November, but who are taking hours out of their day to talk to other fellow Americans on behalf of this ticket.
When you make the calls, do you identify yourself as mayor of Albany?
So I have not made the calls yet. I've fired up. I'm like the cheerleader for the people making the calls. But I will be making calls. I will be going door to door in Pennsylvania. I've been working with some of my fellow mayors on coordinating going into those swing states and campaigning. And I will say, yes, I'm the mayor. Like on that call, I say, I'm the mayor.
Yeah.
I was the mayor under the other guy. And this is what happened. This is why I'm fighting for Kamala.
The reason I asked the question is not to... not to know what you're doing at midnight, but more to the point that if somebody has a specific question, if you're calling people and they have a specific question, that there's someone there who is able to answer it.
That's right. And the way that these phone banks work is that there's a training and there are talking points, and then there's always a link that you can send people to get more information. We don't expect the average person to be able to answer a question that for example, our Wall Street guy might ask. It would be very specific and detailed, but they are trained to say, here's where you can get more information, email this person and they'll get back to you. And so that's the MO, but there is a fair amount of detail, and it is about reaching out and hearing from most of these folks. Are, you know, I'm a teacher. I'm retired. I work as a nurse, and I'm taking my time to call you to tell you why I'm supporting this ticket and why I think you should vote in November.
Go ahead.
And there's this incredible network of various different groups. I'm part of the Jewish Women for Kamala group, and they're doing phone banking. And then you've got White Guys for Kamala, and you've got all beer drinkers for. I mean, you've got all different kinds of groups, and everybody is getting engaged because they understand what's at stake. And that's. I don't think that we've been at this precipice of the public understanding what's at stake here for a very, very long time. Maybe not since World War II, to be quite honest with you, because we were fighting fascism then and we're fighting fascism now.
Nonetheless, I mean, the Electoral College is still looking less than ideal, even given her improvement in the polls and her strong odds in the gambling circles. The Electoral College is still a little bit scary to me. And I think that, you know, the fact that that the mayor is going to Pennsylvania to do this outreach, right, is really important. And you can see on the, like, volunteer maps, like the maps of where the Harris campaign is doing, you know, tremendous work and a lot of groundwork, that those sort of, you know, tornado valley, if you will, almost up through the middle there is still not quite there, which is a little scary, right?
But that's where they're going to be spending the next 70 days.
Yeah.
I mean, really. They're not
and those
coming
journalists
to New York.
Are going to get all the interviews, yeah. And then what? Albany.
Yeah, right. No. They're not coming. They're not coming to New York. They're not coming to Massachusetts. They're staying in the swing states, which is where they need to be.
All right. A couple letters, and then we'll go to a break here at the top of the hour. I just want to finish the letters out for what I have in front of me. Kathleen says, given the propensity of the press to seize on gotcha moments by Democrats, that's what she has to lose. Coverage of Hillary, Joe, Kamala, with every little thing torn apart and its normalizing of Trump. Why trust the press? Sorry, press, says Kathleen. Then we go to Ruth. If the mics are on the whole time, Trump can just talk and talk and talk and talk and drown out anything Harris tries to say. Harris can say, excuse me, I'm speaking, as many times as she wants to, but she can't actually make him shut up without walking over to him and putting her hand over his mouth. I think only the speaker's mic should be on. And this letter from Tim. The Harris-Walz team will win. After all the punditry polling and wonkish talk, the simple matter is Harris-Walz are a breath of fresh air. It is as simple as that. The past 7.5 years of presidential politics has been rather smelly. Well, I wish it was simple as an air freshener, but I don't know.
Well, I think that electoral map is the one that is, you know, very scary. And it's going to be decided in a small number of states by a small number of votes. And I think the concern is also that unless it is definitive in some of these states where we win by a lot of votes, that the Trump campaign will tie this up in court for months and months and months, and sow the seeds of distrust that he's already done a great job of sowing. And you know, I think I want to live in peace and harmony with my fellow Americans, even those that don't agree with me. I think that you know, that's the thing that has us most concerned.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with our terrific group. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back after news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 26th of August, 6 minutes past 10 o'clock. I'm Joe Donahue, a political consultant and lobbyist. Libby Post is here, executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Nick Rangel joins us, Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman, and Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan, all joining us on the panel this morning. We welcome your letters, as always, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you, panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to some other things happening. So I wanted to, there was a New York Times article in yesterday's edition that I would like to talk about for a moment, and that having to do with immigration, with Harris and Democrats walking a delicate and harder line is the is the headline for this particular article. When Vice President Kamala Harris accepted the Democratic presidential nomination last week at her party's convention in Chicago, she sought to strike a delicate balance on the issue of immigration, promising to approach enforcement and security at the nation's southern border as the prosecutor she once was, without abandoning the country's values. I know we can live up to our proud heritage as a nation of immigrants and reform our broken immigration system, she said on Thursday night. We can create an earned pathway to citizenship and secure our border. It was the kind of equilibrium on the issue that Democrats had strived for all week, a leveling between calls for more officers and judges at the country's southern border and a system that treats people humanely, between promises to uphold the law and rebukes of the fear-mongering over the other that has permeated the national immigration debate. But the overall message on immigration from the Democratic Party in the past week, as it has been since Ms. Harris announced her candidacy last month, has been decidedly more hard-line than it has been in decades. The shift reflects just how much of a political vulnerability the issue remains for Kamala Harris and down-ballot Democratic candidates in November.
Mayor. Well, I think it is a vulnerability. And as a mayor, we are a city that is welcoming. We are a city that has been a refugee resettlement committee or community for well over a decade. And we also want to ensure that people coming to our city seeking a new life in the United States have the ability to work and have the same protections from whether it is being paid a minimum wage, having the security of OSHA, and, you know, the other protections that we provide to a workforce. And so we do need to get this right. We need to ensure that there is a pathway, and it has to be a legal pathway, but it has to include work authorization. And that's what needs to be fixed. We do it for refugees, and we need to ensure that there's a way of providing fast work authorizations to people who are legally seeking asylum or otherwise immigrating to this country. And that not only keeps our communities safe, and we can look our neighbors in the eye and say, yes, we know that we have immigrants coming here. This is wonderful for our economy. They're filling jobs. They're desperately needed in our workforce. And we know that they are protected the same way that any other worker is protected, and that they're not going to be taken advantage of, that they're not going to be victimized. And that is where, when you don't have those protections, you start to open up the things that people are concerned about, human trafficking and things that happen behind the scenes that can then often lead to challenges down the road. And so this is about making sure that we can say to our fellow Americans, yes, we have a system. We know who these individuals are, and they're on a path to being able to work and support themselves. And we can say to those coming to our community, you're safe here. And you have protections here. These are people who pay taxes. These are people who we want to be part of our economy. But we do need common sense controls and pathways to allowing people to be here legally so that they can't be victimized and so that they are able to fully participate in our economy. And I think that that is a vulnerability that the Republicans have taken advantage of. Anytime somebody without legal status commits a crime, it's front page news, and it's horrific. We know for a fact that immigrants are far, far, far less likely to commit crimes than citizens are, than our fellow Americans are.
Right.
We know that they are far, far more likely to be victims of crime, and so we've got to ensure that we have more judges, a faster system, and a way for people to get into this country that makes sense, that encourages them to wait and enter the country when they have an interview, when they have the ability to be vetted, and then get that work authorization.
One of the things in the three or four paragraphs that I read, there was a line in there about those who are seeking office down ballot. And I'm curious, fresh from the convention, of what your sense is of those who are running, especially, I mean, I say border states, but I mean, as you rightly point out, it affects us here in Albany, so or in New York State. So regardless of where you are, of how that issue is hitting.
Yeah, I think the congressional candidates, for example, in New York, we're trying to win back 5 seats. We think we have a really good shot at winning all 5 back, certainly 4 of them. But this is going to be an issue in every single one of those races. When you look at the fear-mongering happening in New York City, on Long Island, with respect to this issue, this is going to be a challenge. And I think it has continued to be vexing for Democrats. And I think we need to be very clear on our messaging that we need to welcome people, but we also need to ensure that all of us are doing that in a way that is transparent and that ensures safety and a fast path to being able to be self-sufficient. And we've seen it. I mean, people, you know, I encourage people, come to Albany. Come and see what we do with refugee families who come here from war-torn countries from all over the world. And they come, they're employed. Look, it's not a panacea. There are still challenges. There are still struggles. But we have a way of doing this. We have a way of working with employers. But the work authorization piece of this is what's crucial.
Nick?
Ditto? No, I think that's true. But, sorry. You caught me off guard. I wasn't even looking at you.
No,
I didn't
I'm
have
sorry.
My hand up.
Well, you know what? You looked.
I was pensive.
When the mayor was talking, you seemed engaged, and I apologize. I misread the situation, but by the way.
No, I was looking up quotes from Trump on immigration and the language he uses to contrast with Harris and the Democratic Party, which is we need to be welcoming, we need to be smart, we need to be inclusive, but we also need a path to like economic stability. Very reasonable things. And on the other hand, we have immigrants are tainting the blood of Americans. Mm-hmm. And I'm over here as a Hispanic woman like, ooh, I've been tainted though. Like, what does that mean? Like, that's most of America. Like, I just can't even wrap my look around the room. Like, how many people have been tainted by immigrant blood? Lots.
We're all.
I don't get it.
In my family, there was a little bit of Belgian that slipped in there somehow.
Ooh.
I know.
Ooh. Yeah, you got to watch out.
Look, I think the mayor's right. Immigration is a superpower for our country. If you look at Japan or at China, they would love to have the problems we have in terms of having too many people want to get here and a country and an ethic and values that allow people to effectively become members of our country. I think politically, Trump has an interesting view towards the border. And the fact that he keeps focusing on the wall, I finally sort of thought this through. And if you think about the white Christian nationalism and the tide of demographics that he's trying to at least sell people that he's stemming, it's clear why he goes to the wall. Because there's this fiction that if you just plug the hole, right, that the white Christians will still be the center of this country. Now, of course, we all know even if you hermetically sealed the country, the demographics would still swamp the white population eventually in this country. And so it's this bizarre approach that he takes. I do think you have to what Greg Abbott did was entirely unethical, probably illegal in many cases. But I do think he all of a sudden took this issue that Biden and his administration had effectively kept warm by largely ignoring the crisis. And Abbott made it an issue in every state in a way that it hadn't been before. And it does underscore the need for change and some tough choices about how we decide who comes in. Because letting everybody come in and letting them hang out, you know, in Texas or in Arizona or whatever the state of choice is, that doesn't work. We need a different system. But the fact that the Democrats have gotten hold of it and that Kamala Harris has articulated a pretty reasonable policy, I think should be enough to help. But the unfortunate thing is the Biden administration kept this warm and Abbott made it more than just a border crisis.
But let's not forget, there was a bipartisan immigration deal on the table that was ready to go, right? And Trump called the Republicans and said, don't pass it because it's going to take away an issue for me in the campaign. So it wasn't like Biden was just keeping it warm. They were trying to get something done, and Trump screwed the pooch.
Look, I don't disagree with the order of events that you've... Of course, I'm well aware of what happened. But for Biden to let it roll for 3.5 years and then on the eve of an election say, well, let's get a solution so we can take this off the table, he was too late.
No, I disagree.
Yes, he was. He was factually too late because Trump stopped it.
Trump would have stopped it if it was in year one, year two, year three, or year four. That doesn't matter. The issue is that it took this long to get the Republicans to come to the table and make some rational decisions about how to deal with our immigration policy. They didn't want to do it, but they knew also it was going to be an issue for them locally.
My understanding of the issue is that the Democrats wouldn't give up the Dreamer path to citizenship until the last deal that was on the table, where they said, all right, we'll give you what you want and we'll leave Dreamers out, and they had a deal. However it is exactly it came about, the administration, if you roll back the clock now, the Biden administration should have done more sooner.
The greatest threat to the American economy is our inability to fix immigration.
Right.
When you look at what is happening, and I don't want to signal out, but when you look at what is happening at hospitals across this country, when you look at what is happening with the locally owned businesses, large businesses, manufacturing, whether it's the focus that we have here on AI and chip fab or on offshore wind, the biggest threat to that is lack of workforce. We need immigrants, and we can figure this out. We have the technology, we have the ability, and we need to be serious about it and figure it out and stop blaming Democrat mayors or, you know, the Democrat in the White House. This has been screwed up, and Democrats and Republicans both have responsibility towards that. But we need to get it fixed. The future of upstate New York depends on immigration. The farms up here, every employer up here, it depends on immigration, whether that be short-term visas for seasonal help or a pathway to citizenship. We need to get this right. And what the decisions we make today are going to determine what this economy is going to be like 5 years from now.
And nobody's taking anybody's jobs because these folks don't want to work in the fields. They don't want to do the farm work. My son's an organic farmer. He relies on whatever the visa thing is to bring people in for the summer. You know, and it's been really, really tough because of all of this stuff. But that means then food rots in the fields and doesn't get to the table. And that impacts poor people more than anybody else. So,
yeah, I think we're seeing that play out, too. Florida is got in a precarious situation there. Development has been on pause. They don't have enough people working in construction jobs. They've got farms that are losing crops because they have no one to pick vegetables. And that's a state that had a Republican solution, which was to try to ship people out and have a rhetoric that's very anti-immigrant. And you see on the ground how that's a failed approach.
So we touched on this, but Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump went to a section along Arizona's border with Mexico over the weekend to heap praise on the structure standing to his right, the Rolls-Royce of walls, he called it, and lament the unused segments lying to his left. Joining him there, Border Patrol Union leader Paul Perez called the standing fence Trump Wall. And the idle parts, Kamala Wall, after his Democratic opponent, Vice President Kamala Harris. Those labels, inaccurate. The section of 20-foot steel slats was actually built during the administration of President Obama. Trump added the unfinished extension up the hillside, an engineering challenge that cost at least $35 million a mile. The unused panels of 30-foot beams were procured during the Trump administration and were never erected. Where you were, that was kind of a joke today. John Ladd, a Trump supporter whose ranch extends along the border, said while driving the dirt road along the barrier, the gapped panels, making a flip book out of the shrubby trees and grass on the other side. Had to be in front of Trump's wall, but you went to Montezuma, and that is Obama's wall. I mean, besides just being funny and ill-informed, it goes to show that there's still this fiction that's being written about the wall and that Mexico is going to pay for it. And that was something that was talked about so much that many people still believe it and thought that it has that during the Trump administration came to fruition.
So I've been to the border and walked the wall with Border Patrol. And when you think about the complexity of this and the fact that there are cartels that build tunnels under these walls and that we have these magical things called drones that can fly over the walls, I understand the symbolism of it. I don't live in a border community. I'm not a person who could be out on my ranch and find, you know, someone who has died trying to cross the border. This is very real to the people who live in these communities, and we're talking about the wrong thing. We're talking about the wrong thing. We need to get serious about the policies that we need to put in place and the way that we keep ourselves secure. Because guess what? We have these magical things called drones now, and we have a lot more technology that we can use to monitor the border. We need to put policies in place that make it less appealing for people. I want to shut down these cartels that engage in human trafficking. And that happens when you have policy that allows people to come across the border without spending their life savings or going into debt and then having to work off that debt when they get here, doing God knows what.
Right.
And so it requires, you know, I know that the Biden administration is famous for saying it. And as a mayor, I've held them to account for it. This all of government approach. We need more judges. We need a more streamlined system. And we need to be focused on keeping our community safe. But the overwhelming majority of drug smugglers are U.S. citizens. They're not immigrants. And so, you know, when we look at these ads, these scare tactics that the Republicans have engaged in, showing like piles of fentanyl pills and human trafficking, you know, these are cartels that in most instances, there is deep cooperation and collaboration among U.S. citizens engaging in this illicit activity.
Anybody else on that, Mark?
Oh, as I said, the locus of the wall is a fiction that Trump holds out for his white Christian nationals, that somehow there's going to be a physical barrier to stem the tide that they're afraid of. Even on the fentanyl trade, frankly, you've got to deal with the demand side of that equation. It is so small and so cheap and so easy to smuggle that you have to deal with the demand side of the fentanyl equation, or it'll just find another way into your country. The other absurd thing about the wall is, even if, you know, tomorrow you could wave a magic wand and build it all, it would be so ineffective that the country would never stomach the cost of maintaining it over the long term. So it's just it's an interesting fantasy to entertain, but it's not a serious solution to the issues.
All right, let's go to a couple of letters, and then we'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll finish up our program with this terrific panel. Kathleen says, the Trumpers I talk to don't seem to have a clue as to what Joe Biden has accomplished, and I suspect that's because they're watching nothing but Fox News. That is a frightening thought, but certainly nothing new, right?
No, they've been watching Fox News for years.
And just something that has to be of getting the message across, right?
Well, but I think that that's really one of the messages of the convention, was that it is time to reengage with that uncle that you stopped talking to because of the big fight that you had at the Thanksgiving table, that neighbor who you used to chat with over the fence or the hedgerow, and just talk about, how are you doing? How is your family? I just got a bill for, you know, my prescription. Oh, my God, I can't believe how much money I'm saving now. Right? Like, whatever it is that you can engage that person on. And I think that there is receptiveness, and I've seen it personally. I've had conversations with Republicans who said, you know, this is the first time I've really sat down and talked to a Democrat, and it hasn't ended in a screaming match. And so we've got to take that opportunity. I think that this new ticket has energized people. They're paying attention, and that there is a receptiveness. And so don't be afraid, because every vote is going to matter. And I think there's an openness. If we don't demonize people, if we don't call them stupid for supporting Trump in the past, if we don't make them less than, and if we really look at what their lived reality is, I think that the policies and the messages of the Harris-Walz ticket speak to them, and we have to create the space for that. So I wouldn't give up on anyone.
I also think the emotion of the Harris-Walz campaign is very, very positive. I read a piece over the weekend about an evangelical for Harris who's going out and speaking to other evangelicals about the notion of kindness and how integral that is. I mean, it's part of the Judeo-Christian ethic. I mean, we've got it in Judaism, you guys have it in Christianity, but that kindness is core to who we are as people, and that Trump has totally thrown that out of the window, and it has alienated, his rhetoric has alienated some evangelicals, and they're starting to talk about this and starting to recognize that kindness, the joy, being nicer to people, not demonizing people, is really where their ethics are and not in the Trump camp. And I think we'll see. It's not going to be a whirlwind or a tidal wave, but I think we're going to see, like we're going to see some Republicans voting for Harris, I think we'll see some evangelicals also voting for Harris, because they want to return to a time when vitriol was not the way of our life. They want to return to a time when we were kind to one another, where we did help our neighbors, where we did treat others as we want ourselves to be treated.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll wrap up this edition of the panel, and we still have time for your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will do all of that after this short break and BBC News. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Quite a group this morning. We welcome Libby Post, Nick Rangel, Mark Whitman, and Mayor of Albany, Kathy Sheehan. And we welcome you as well. Panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. We have just under 15 minutes or so to get in a bunch of topics that I would like to talk about. And one is the Israel-Lebanon attacks, the escalating strikes across the Israel-Lebanon border fueled the fears of a bigger conflagration, but both sides say that they are hoping that will not happen, that they will de-escalate for now. Amid fears of an all-out war between Israel and Hezbollah forces in Lebanon, the two sides on Sunday mounted the biggest round of cross-border strikes since the war in Gaza began, with Israel bombing dozens of sites in a preemptive attack, and Hezbollah launching hundreds of rockets and drones. Within hours, both sides appeared to de-escalate, at least temporarily, but signaled that the violence and dangerous tensions could very well continue. Who would like to start off on thoughts on... nobody wants to talk
well,
about this.
Well, I do think this weekend's tit-for-tat underscores a couple of things. I'm still pretty convinced that Iran doesn't want to get into it with Israel and really start an all-out war. Because as I've said before, I think if Iran and Israel really get into it, Israel and the United States are going to decide to take the can opener and get rid of Iranians' nuclear capabilities. Once you're in, there's no reason to go half-baked on that one. Frankly, that's an issue that administrations have been kicking down the road for a long time. There's still hope that the next supreme leader in Iran, who we expect to take power relatively soon given age, age of the current one, takes a different tact towards the Middle East and towards Iran's nuclear power, or sorry, nuclear weaponry. But at some point, if they don't, we, and I mean Israel and the United States, are going to have to solve that conundrum. I do think there's a fallacy that we ought to highlight that's been circulating, which is that if there is a deal ever between Israel and Hamas, that deal will bring peace to all of the warring parties. I think that's a little bit, at least calm things down for a while. That may prove overly optimistic, and I just want to flag that. I think we should be careful. And lastly, I do want to say there was a I don't mean to find dark humor in this situation, but there was a funny headline in The Economist after Yahya Sinwar, who was the military leader and now is the leader of Hamas, took power. There was a picture of him in a Nixon-like pose with his hands aloft. And The Economist had the headline, "Everyone for More War, Raise Your Hands," underneath it. I don't know how, with him at the head of Hamas and Netanyahu and his twisted motivations at the head of Israel, we come to a peace agreement when the Biden administration, Harris, you know, wishes there would be one before the final days of the election. So I'm afraid we're in for a rough time. But I do think there's a buffer here because I don't think Iran wants to start the real endgame because they know they'd lose it. And also, I'm not even sure Iran has the wherewithal to withstand that game. They've got less than six. On a regular basis, they keep less than 6 days' worth of currency to pay the government employees on hand. That's a regime that's pretty stretched in other ways as well.
And meanwhile, the suffering continues, and it's tragic. It's tragic.
I think we as the U.S. ought to stop letting Israel off the hook on that. I really do think, you know, the Bernie Sanders, like, you got to look, it's OK to pursue a war against Hamas, but you can't starve people in Gaza as a result. I think there needs to be more pressure put on Israel, you know, for vaccinations as well as for food.
And yet you have a terrorist organization who uses these people as human shields.
Yeah, yeah.
So
right.
It's a
no win.
It's a no win situation. And so we, you know, I think we can be, you know, for ending this war, for bringing humanitarian aid to Gaza, ending the tragedies that are happening in families every day. And people have to be intellectually honest about the fact that the reason many of those people are there is because Hamas is using them as human shields.
All right. I want to get to another topic. For a couple of visits now, I've been promising Nick that we would talk about affordable housing. So I want to make sure that we do that in our moments here. And that is, there's a New York Times article that gives us a good reason to discuss this that was published in the Weekend Edition. For the poorest Americans, finding an apartment to rent or a home to buy often means tapping into a vast network of nonprofit groups that use public or charitable funds to rehab or build affordable housing. Over the past year, the skyrocketing cost of property insurance has put that network on shaky grounds. Costs are rising for homeowners of all types, and in states like Florida, Texas, California, it has become harder and harder to get insurance at all. The industry says bigger, more frequent storms, along with increased home prices and material with labor costs, are forcing them to raise premiums or simply to stop writing policies. Wealthier homeowners can go without insurance if they can buy a home without a mortgage. Landlords of market rate apartments can raise the rent to adjust to the higher cost. But for the 4,000 or so nonprofits and developers that aren't allowed to raise rents or are selling homes only to buyers with the most constrained budgets, the soaring cost of insurance is an existential threat. The problem is most serious in coastal states hit hard by severe weather. But Frank Woodruff, the executive director of the Community Opportunity Alliance, a trade group representing nonprofit housing developers, warned of a wider crisis. If it spreads further, it could threaten to end affordable housing development as we know it.
Well, before you get to the economics of that, there's something missing from that article. And that is the fact that it has spread. In New York State, our own Albany Housing Authority, which has over 2,000 units of affordable housing, has seen their insurance rates go from a couple hundred thousand dollars a year to over $3 million. And the reason that is being cited is a crime score. So we think redlining is over. It ain't over. When you layer on a crime score, which I have no idea how that really impacts the cost to the insurance company, since, you know, we're talking about these public housing authority buildings, for which when I looked and I asked for their claims, they've seen a decrease in the number of claims that they have made on their insurance policies. And I think the biggest year they had a claim of like $125,000, right? So there is no correlation between the risk that is being experienced and the increase in insurance. And this is going to make it nearly impossible for housing authorities. And this is happening all across New York State. We've been to see, thanks to his, concern about this, Neil Breslin about this, who's leaving, but he's the chair of the insurance committee. But this is impacting. It's not just weather. So I just want to be very clear. There is, again, a crime score that is being used by insurance companies to rate homeowners and property owners in areas that are perceived to be high crime.
Yeah, and that's acutely specific. This is accurate. There's a bill in the legislature that would try to tackle that in New York State. And it's not just public housing facilities, though. It's any affordable housing. And in fact, the nature, if your housing development is deemed an affordable housing development, that designation itself can also increase the insurance rates on that property. And you see that really widespread in New York City.
And again, I mean, I've asked for the data. There is no correlation that I can see. Somebody would have to explain it to me between claims and this increase that we're seeing.
And I think it applies not just to housing, but also to vehicle insurance. If you own a car and you live in the South End where I used to live, your insurance is higher than if you live in a different zip code in the same city.
It's about profits. That's the bottom line.
It's greed,
it really
right?
is. It is greed. I mean, you know, on a.
All right, here's, Mark.
Well, wait. I mean, renters. I mean, this might seem minor to people, but if more and more landlords are saying you need to get renter's insurance, right? If you own a certain breed of dog, you won't be able to get renter's insurance. You'd have to give up your dog, and it's something we're trying to work on. We did away with that discrimination in homeowners. But it's really about greed. And, yeah, I know that there have been horrific situations, weather situations and all the rest of that stuff. But then people are getting gouged by flood insurance and other kinds of weather-related insurance. And it's just it's about shareholders and wanting to be able to turn a profit.
I can't speak to the issue around crime rates and their effect on property insurance. Greed's an easy thing to blame, if you will. But what I would say, look, if my homeowner's insurance went up by too much, I would go bid it out. So the first question is, what does the state do about that?
Fewer and fewer insurance companies are willing to write insurance, and that's part of the problem.
Okay, but if they're all greedy and they're looking to make money, and you come to them and say, would you like to make money off me? And they say no. Then there's something about the way the system's working. The article that we read was about the incredible cost rises in cost of homeowners insurance driving the lower end of the market ever more expensive. You know, I know, for instance, in California, the state will not let insurance companies price in the expectation of future experience with weather into their current insurance rates. They can only look at historical data, and so they leave the state. If the government actually is in a unique position in this case, because the government can afford tremendous losses. It's a big entity. It can take losses. It should work alongside insurance companies in a market-based system to try and make more bids available to those who have property. So instead of Kamala Harris is handing everybody $25,000 and watching the price of housing raise by, oh, $25,000, having the government be sort of an active but yet market participant in the insurance industry, in the housing or homeowners insurance industry, seems a more plausible solution to me. There's a lot that needs to be done. The other thing that needs to be done around New York State is, can you imagine if we had bullet trains going into New York City, how many of the surrounding areas would immediately be rejuvenated because people could work in the city and buy these empty shells of homes in these different cities. I mean, there are solutions, but I honestly do think rather than point to greed, you need to sort of roll. I mean, I'm sure civic leaders are doing this, but you need to roll up your sleeves and start to look at a broad array of solutions here, because it is going to be more expensive to own property in a world where weather damage is ever more frequent and ever more severe.
We are out of time, so Mark Whitman gets the final word on this Monday edition. We will, my thanks to all of you. We will certainly come back and discuss these issues in more detail over the days to come. My thanks to everybody, Nick Rangel, Mayor Sheehan, Mark Whitman, and Libby Post. Thanks so much. I so appreciate you being here. We'll take a break and come back with the Congressional Corner next.